with a positive preparation for disaster. This is Community Alert, keeping you informed about how to be prepared, not if, but when disaster strikes. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on KZSB, AM 1290, Santa Barbara News Press Radio.
Welcome, folks, to Community Alert, taking a closer look at our personal and neighborhood preparations for disaster. Myself, Ted Adams, and my co-host, Mike Williams, are here today with Bill Baker, who is with Information Station Specialists in Michigan, ISS, we'll be referring to. And he is the manufacturer of our radio station on San Marcos Pass, the Semper's radio station. Welcome, Bill. Thanks for coming on the program.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me on.
Thank you, Bill.
Absolutely. And Mike, you want to cover this?
Well, thank you, Ted. Start off with the website of the week, and it's going to be for Bill's company, theradiosource.com. That's www.theradiosource, all one word, .com. And let me give you their phone number while we're thinking about it. It's 616-772-2300. That's 616-772-2300. And they're based out of Michigan. Bill, thank you for taking time to come out to talk to us. I appreciate that.
Well, this is great.
Yeah. Well, let's, for the benefit of the audience, let me just do a quick little history. Back in 2005, we had the Gaviota fire, and now the outgrowth of the fire was how are people going to get information, because the freeway was closed in both directions, and the primary highway going through our community, 154, became the freeway for a good portion of the rest of the day. And as a result of that, in a series of meetings, primarily through an organization here locally called EPIC, the Wildland Residents Association started the 1040 station, Semper's, and that's become history since then. And actually, Community Alert became an outgrowth of that also, because people got interested in us actually doing a community interactive program, which that's what we're doing now. And we want to do that through a commercial station, not through low power. So anyway, that's kind of how we got to know you, and you've been an integral part of making that all happen for us. I'd like to kind of start off with, what is low power radio, and how did you guys get into that business?
Well, I'll start with the first part of your question. Low power radio, for most of the people that are listening now, you know, they may have some familiarity with this in general. Maybe they've seen a sign on the freeway. Maybe they've seen something in front of somebody's home advertising, you know, listen to a radio station that talks about the sale of a particular property that they're looking at. So most people have a familiarity when they go to LAX with a particular radio signal over a limited area that have specific content. But just to kind of take a broad view, there's really about four kinds of low-power radio. If you kind of think of a two-by-two matrix, you've got licensed and unlicensed types, and then you have AM and FM types. What we're not talking about really today are the unlicensed radios, like the kind of thing that you see selling a house in front of somebody's yard. And we're not talking about the kind of product that you might have heard of if you're around the LA area or Santa Barbara area, called low-power FM, which is actually more of a tiny commercial radio station. What we're talking about today really is a licensed low-power AM service of the type that you use there at Semper's, Mike.
Okay, so how did ISS come to be? I mean, this was a concept that you started years ago, isn't it?
Well, not really. I think we've honed a lot of things with low-power radio. Obviously, we started our own company and such, but it was already there. just to tell a quick story, I went camping. I'm sure people in your area, when the fires aren't burning, do camp in the woods, right? and so I went camping one day, and I found that it was wintertime, and my normal sources of firewood and places I would buy things were all closed. And I thought, you know, how hard would it be to have a tiny radio station that just covers the campgrounds, that tells people that are in the off-season about things they wouldn't normally know about? So that sort of launched me in a direction of an investigation of, well, you know, is there a tiny radio station that could be used for information for something like that? And what serendipity found that basically in 1977, about 3 years before this camping trip, the FCC had opened up a new kind of broadcasting, which in FCC parlance is called Traveler's Information Station. It's listed under Part 90 of the FCC rules, not the Part 73 thing that, you know, where you've got KFI and, the, you know, the, your radio station, for example, the commercial boys are under Part 73. But travelers' information stations, despite the fact that they inhabit the AM band, they're not under Part 73. They're under Part 90, more like your walkie-talkies and your two-way system. But about 3 years before this camping trip that I was alluding to, the FCC had opened up this special kind of broadcasting. We call it today emergency advisory radio, which is what it's used for in many cases. But the real legal underpinnings for the service is called a traveler's information station.
Now, you guys have been doing this for how long?
We're kind of an upstart. We're in our 30th year on this right now. But you know, it's funny. We continue to learn things constantly about this, and because it's something that is so useful, every day here at ISS, somebody calls us with an idea that you know we never would have thought of, and we'll talk about those a little bit more. But let me tell you a little bit more about these travelers' information stations and how they're different from the commercial things. You might remember, in fact, the station that's down at LAX on 530, some of your listeners may have even flown in and out of that airport from time to time. And the 530 was one of the only frequencies that used to be allowed, and the other end of the band was 1610. And this was in the days when you didn't have numbers on your radio. You actually had a knob.
Right.
And the knob, you kind of turned it, and there was a thing that slid left and right across the front.
Yeah, it always
radio.
Broke off, and you had to glue it back on.
Right. That was called analog. I can spell that for you if you like. But analog was kind of fun because of a number of things, and it was very different than digital, and the band had edges to it. And so what happened was somebody out in Wyoming at Yellowstone National Park and some other people out in Maryland, where there's a big bridge, said to the FCC, look, you know, there's no radio station. There's only five radio stations in the entire state of Wyoming, and there's some frequency space out here in the Baltimore area. Why can't we put a small radio system that's not going to interfere with anybody with a range of a few miles that specifically is going to talk content having to do with Yellowstone or with this particular bridge? And the FCC, over a lot of objections and hurdles in 1977, was persuaded to allow this law. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but we're the only country really in the hemisphere that has anything quite like this. So the Travelers Information Stations began, and we found out about them and began to sort of make them our business. They're not a commercial station. The content has to be non-commercial. In fact, it's got to be only voice. You can't even play any Led Zeppelin, Mike. And I know that that's a limiting factor for you there.
It is.
At Simpers. But the wattage is 10 watts, not 10,000 watts. And that normally yields a range of a number of miles, 3, 4, 5 miles typically around the country. So, again, despite the fact that they sit on the AM band, they're not like a 50,000-watt radio station. Now, those of you who remember this days of analog might remember that it used to be that your radio ended up at 1600, and the top radio station on the band was one of these travelers' information frequencies at 1610. But about 1990, the FCC decided to stretch your AM radio up to 1700, and then they had a dilemma. What do we do with that 1610 radio frequency? Do we keep it as a special frequency for these traveler information emergency stations and kind of make it a little island out there in the middle? Or do we push it up to 1710 at the top end again? Or, and this is what they decided to do, was to make it a ubiquitous service across the entire 530 to 1700 radio frequency band. And so about 1990, there began to spring up radio stations that fit the parameters on all kinds of AM frequencies, like the 1040.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the service really inhabits the AM band just like the commercial guys do, just under some different rules.
Well, it's really worked out well for us. And when we come back from the break, we can talk about some of the specifics that you did for us for Sempers and why Sempers became kind of a torch, if you will, for emergency services and broadcasting in Southern California. This is Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster. Mike Williams, Ted Adam, Richard Dugan on the board. Today we're visiting with Bill Baker from Information Station Specialist. We'll be back with you in just a minute. This is KZSB AM 1290, Santa Barbara News Press Radio and newspress.com.
Welcome back, folks, to Community Alert. This is Ted Adams, my co-host, Mike Williams. We're here today taking a closer look at our personal and neighborhood preparations for disaster. Our guest today is Bill Baker, who is with Information Station Specialist in Michigan. He's talking to us on the phone about low-power radio stations and some of the lore and the applications of those stations. Mike, you want to go for
Let me
that?
Give the website out again, Ted. It's www.theradiosource.com. That's www.theradiosource.com. ISS is the vendor of our station that we use in Sempers, 1040 AM. They're the vendor over at UCSB. They're the vendor down at Montecito Fire. Bill, I think you got a couple of stations that popped up in Ojai and Ventura and Santa Paula, too, I believe. Isn't that correct?
There's a lot of them in the LA Basin or the general Santa Barbara area in particular.
Yeah, I get a lot of phone calls from people wanting to know how we did it, why we did it, what works, what doesn't work, how much administration does it take. It's kind of interesting, some of the questions I got. I even had the United Nations call me, believe it or not. They wanted
really?
To know. They called, and it was a study that was being done for in Africa and using low power radio there to basically deal with some of the famine issues and emergency and unrest that they have over there. And they were looking at the information that came, I presume, off your website as to what we had and why we did it. It's interesting, the calls I get.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
By the way, Bill, I have a quick question for you. You're talking, and obviously you stay up on top of the all of the FCC rules and regs and how much power you can put out. There are no radio stations broadcasting, let's say, in the Yosemite Park or something along those lines. So why would they be limiting a low-power station like that to providing information throughout the park? Obviously, if you were AM, you're going to be restricted to some degree, FM even more so because it's line of sight. But what about that in terms of power output?
In other words, why don't they allow larger power output in certain scenarios?
Right. I mean, certainly you'd have a lower output in a place like L.A. in the suburbs because you have so many other radio stations that are doing other things, so you don't want to bleed over. But if you're out in the middle of nowhere, I mean, let's say out in the middle of Los Padres National Forest, there are no radio stations out there. Or in Yosemite or Yellowstone. There are no radio stations out there, so why couldn't you boost the power if people needed information, that kind of thing, similar to what Sempers does?
Yeah, unlike the FCC, you're thinking rather logically.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So
that's been a problem on this show repeatedly.
and actually, it is. It is logical that you could use more power in some places. The FCC really has these relegated to a kind of a cookie-cutter scenario. Mm-hmm. And, commercial broadcasters and such watch the service and want to make sure that technically it doesn't get out of bounds and interfere. And I think part of the reason is just to make sure that there's a good firm boundary to prevent interference. However, the FCC has, in some cases, allowed more power. And LAX actually is a good example of that. LAX runs more power than most other stations, and it's because of the potential for mischief at the airport there. That's the case that they've been able to make, and the FCC agreed with that. And so, actually, LAX runs, I want to say, I'm probably out of bounds here. I know they run a higher field and a little bit higher wattage for bigger coverage. You'll find that you can pick up that 530 just about all over that area. And there have been a couple other instances where they've done that as well for highway departments where there's lots of interference from the environment. Mm-hmm. But in general, it's a high hurdle to be able to jump with the commission to get over that 10 watts.
Well, you know, that's a good question, Richard, because I get asked that a lot. Because one of the driving forces behind the Sempers station was that most of the radio stations in Santa Barbara that serve Santa Barbara are automated at night and on the weekends. And the community as a whole wanted to be able to get real-time information as effectively as possible. Ironically, Sempers is also automated, but we get get to it a little bit quicker. But the issue is, can we expand our range? Well, the idea behind Simpers was to keep it narrow to the specific community in which we wanted to serve. We actually turned our power down. And that in our surveys, when we get to an area that we were getting out of, we turned the power down to make sure that we didn't get into some of the greater Goleta area. Mm-hmm. So I get a lot of phone calls of people, can't you turn the power up? Can you turn the power up? It's interesting to me the number of calls that I get after the large incidents that people found at 1040 by just dancing through the radio dial. And just they come across us. So it's curious because they do want more signal. They do want more information out there, but that's not the design of the system. Montecito is the same kind of thing. They want to keep the signal in Montecito. They don't want it to get out. So it's almost the same concept that the cell system is based on. You isolated cells. That way you can reuse the frequency throughout the community. You don't have to keep coming up with new channels.
Yeah, and I was even thinking, too, that I guess if you really wanted to expand, you wouldn't necessarily have to raise the power, because obviously you can't. I mean, beyond 10 watts.
Sure.
You could have, Bill, couldn't you have translators or repeaters somewhere along the way? Is that, can that be built into a system, or does the FCC?
Yeah, that's exactly how it's done.
Okay.
A synchronous repeater that may provide information over a contiguous area. One of the other things that keeps the power from being increased is because you guys know, if you got the radio engineering background, you know that it takes a lot more power to increase your coverage significantly. So, for example, you might need to go to 200, 300, or 1,000 watts to really cover a large area, especially in the terrain where you are out there, Mike, really do the job the way you want to, especially at night. And so the facilities become obviously much more expensive and, of course, outside the boundaries of what the FCC conceived of for these stations originally, which was very localized information.
Well, that's it. At that point, you become a commercial radio station, and that's not what we wanted to do. In fact, when we went in with the proposal to do this, there were several major local broadcasters there, some of which were not particularly receptive to the idea that basically an amateur form of broadcaster was going to come into their world. We massaged that and took care of their concerns, and today have great relationships with all the broadcasters, and we mutually share our PSAs and other content. So it's worked out very, very well for us. And I think that was something we started right at the get-go because we foresaw that there might be a conflict. Anyone planning to do one of these stations, I would encourage them to do that probably right out of the box, is get your broadcast community on your side. Get them to help you. That's part of why we do this show through KZSB. One, it's the legality issue. But two, it's working with the broadcast community, because that's the issue, is getting the information out for the public.
In fact, there's broadcasters around the country that actually run these for the local community.
Mm. What about pattern? I know that some stations I've worked for, they have one stick. Now they want to throw up two to go directional, and they adjust the lobes. This is a little more technical for a lot of people. But I don't know what the pattern coverage is for Semper's 1040, but can you do anything in that regards as far as, so to speak, aiming the signal at specific rural communities as opposed to out into a farm field somewhere? In other words, better utilizing that pattern.
Yeah, that's a great question. The FCC has these set up like little circles.
Mm-hmm.
they're omnidirectional, fixed-point location. And, of course, you know that it takes multiple antennas and multiple transmitters with AM to actually shape a signal. And so the baseline underneath the law for these types of systems is single antenna, single location. The best way to do shaping, so to speak, is actually add those repeaters that you were talking about.
Okay.
To try to bring the signal over in another direction.
Well, I know here in Santa Barbara there is a concept of the one radio station to fit all, which geographically isn't possible in Santa Barbara. But there has been a rather substantial push and continues to be to have one station, one frequency that everybody can tune to in the event of emergency, kind of like Clear Channel was way back in World War II. Even KFI on 640 is not a Clear Channel station anymore. It's owned by Clear Channel, but the frequency itself isn't. So I guess that brings me up to the next question, is how has low-powered radio evolved?
Well, it really has over the years, and we kind of implied, that LAX was one of the pioneers actually in there, and it was one of the four cardinal users of this technology going back to the 1970s. Most listeners might be aware that it's also been used by national parks, Department, forests, and highway departments. Caltrans actually is one of the larger users in the United States of low-power radio technology, and we're proud to say that we've supplied almost all the stations that they have, from border to border. So early on, airports, national parks, other national forests and outdoor facilities like Corps of Engineers and highway departments were the four cardinal users. And then back in maybe the mid-1980s, there became the concept, kind of came up to the fore, that, well, you know, really you could use these for tourism as long as you weren't being commercial with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of chambers of commerce and such began to use low-power radio to talk to visitors in non-commercial ways about things that they could experience in the community. And so there was a lot of activity on the visitor information front in the 1980s and in the early 90s. But somewhere during the 1990s, there began to be the concept that local government, cities, counties, and even federal government, federal agencies, could use this technology for public safety applications that really were outside the specific venues of tourism, airports, and park and highway information. And we began to see communities actually putting in stations that could be used for a multiplicity of applications, especially if something went wrong. And the example that I was going to put forward to you was a community up in the Bay Area, Newark, California. I was fortunate to have worked with the community of Newark in 1988. I want to tell you, it was just before the big earthquake up there. Correct me if I'm wrong. And about 6 months later, they had the quake, and it turned out that Newark's little 1610 station ended up informing millions of people, including people all the way across the bay who were able to hear it at that time because it was about the only thing on the frequency, about the status in Newark. And after that, there began to be actually nationally, and especially in the West Coast, lots of these systems going in really to do the kinds of broadcasting that you guys do and that you can do on a day-to-day basis, but knowing that the Part 90 rules allow broadcasting of virtually any information to protect life and property in an emergency.
Hmm.
And so I would say now at least 75% of the systems that we see licensed around the country on a daily basis are with what we call emergency contingency up underneath it.
Well, very good. We got to take a quick break here, Bill. This is Community Alert, not if, but when, positive preparation for disaster. Ted Adams, Mike Williams, Richard Dugan on the board. Visiting today with Bill Baker, Information Station Specialist, KZSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio and newspress.com, and we'll be back with you in just a moment.
The views expressed on Community Alert are not necessarily those of the staff, management, ownership, or advertisers of this station.
Welcome back, folks, to Community Alert. This is Ted Adams, my co-host Mike Williams. We're here today with Bill Baker from Information Station Specialists in Michigan on the phone. Bill, I wanted to just ask you a couple of questions. One was digital. How is that going to affect this particular venue? Is it going to affect it at all, or what's happening with that?
Well, you've heard digital is going to go away, haven't you?
Well,
yeah.
Go away.
I'm sorry. You can edit that out if you want to.
It's here to stay, I'm afraid.
Okay. Well, yeah, digital's not helpful to our cause, really. But the good news is that it really hasn't had a lot of effect on a lot of stations.
Mm-hmm.
The penetration of digital into the AM side, we may have already seen that, the big wave of that. I don't know. We'll
mm-hmm.
see. But having said that, it does widen the sidebands of the commercial stations that are carrying it.
Right.
And so if there's a radio station that is an emergency station and it's too close to a big 50,000-watt station in a monster town like your area, it can be affected negatively.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, there's enough frequency room for them to move. And in the last couple of years, in the Chicago area, actually, I've seen a couple stations skip to a different frequency because of that.
Mm-hmm.
The other question I would ask you about is we've had some discussion about mobile stations, station on a trailer. Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to kind of just expand on that a little bit. Talk to us about that, how those would work, how you'd set them up, how that would affect the frequency designations. Maybe, I don't know if you've done any of those yet, how you notify communities, what frequencies to tune to, et cetera, some of those things.
Right. Portable systems actually are ideal for emergency management. And our company actually invented this back in the 1980s, as far as we know. Caltrans came to us and asked us for a way to take a radio station out on the freeway quickly. Let's say they have an incident where they don't have a fixed point location station. You had a terrible fog accident up on I-5 at one point. Mm-hmm. How would they have brought a highway advisory radio station, which is what they call this, up there quickly? And we came up with a radio station on a truck for them. And that became, obviously, engendered the idea of having a portable system. Quickly, the idea was, okay, pickup trucks don't make a lot of sense. You don't want to park your pickup truck for months at a time at a construction zone with a radio system on it. So consequently, most of them became trailer-mounted systems. So we have a product that we call Roadrunner, which is effectively a solar-powered wireless way of moving what you have at Sempers to any location quickly. And then following that, actually a couple of years ago, one of your communities actually in your area asked us to invent, if you will, a kind of a Pelican case mounted system in a weatherproof case that could be deployed for mass inoculations for, let's say, bird flu or something as scary as that. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of ways to do it, and you touched on a couple good points. How is that licensed? That type of system is licensed under very similar means, except it's done for a territory instead of for a fixed point. Mm-hmm. So you could say, I've got a license with the FCC to move 1040 throughout the entire county, for mm-hmm. example.
And then you'd have a repeater or something that would work through that, or how would that work?
Typically, they're fixed point locations that are simply located at various different locations. They're not actually connected to one another, no.
I see.
Well, the WRA went to the Board of Supervisors with a proposal several years ago to buy two trailers under our license and expand it out, and that was subsequently approved. We've kind of held back on doing that because of some of the other logistical issues associated with that, but the trailer concept seems to be one of the better ideas for Santa Barbara because of the way we're so spread out.
Right, and what we're seeing the motion on right now, since trailers probably cost 3 to 4 times what one of the Pelican case type systems, which is called Radiostat, costs. And, there's a price point, there's a price pressure to keep that price down so that a county could have 4 or 5 different locations in case they needed to do mass inoculations. Mm-hmm. And that's what Ventura County is doing right now.
Mm. Ted, you had another question. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I think that covered it. We got digital. We got trailers. That's good.
Well, since we put this thing on the air, we've gotten, I don't know, hundreds of phone calls regards to how these things work, where do we use them, how much did it cost, how much administration is required with them, increasing of the power. It's amazing because I never set off in life to become in the broadcast business, but I'm kind of enmeshed in it from time to time. And you folks have been tremendously helpful in solving most of the questions that come across to us, and I appreciate that.
I think you have one of the only systems in the country, Mike, which you can operate on a two-way system in case you lose your phone lines.
Well, we did that primarily because of the fires. And the way it's set up, for those who are listening, is that we can actually use our two-way VHF radio system to access the Semper station from wherever we're at and update it with information. So car fires, brush fires, evacuations, things of that nature. If we lose our phone system, we can get into the radio from another source because it doesn't sit at a location where there's somebody actually at. It sits up on top of a mountaintop. So that has been very useful to us. And it also allows us to rebroadcast our radio traffic if we were so inclined to do that. I don't know what application that would fall under at the moment, but we have that capability, yes. So where do you see this going in the future? What are your plans?
Well, the AM band is only becoming more vacant. That's just economics, mm-hmm. and it's FM driving that. If you look at Canada, for example, they have AM stations that are actually switching it off and going to FM and just vacating the channels. And so we're seeing more and more space, especially along the Canadian border, where, you know, there's just more space on the AM band to do emergency advisory radio.
So this is actually going to help us in the long run as far as those that are engaged in the emergency management business, whether publicly or privately, in trying to develop methodologies to help get information out in a timely, effective manner.
People expect information to be on the AM and not the FM band, so it's the perfect place for an information source. And we're even seeing places where frequencies are being crowded out, the FCC inventing frequencies for emergency advisory radio. On the East Coast, the FCC is going to allow the frequency 1710 to be used, and there's nobody on that frequency pretty much in the hemisphere. A community just across from where 9/11 and all happened there in New Jersey that's responsible for taking evacuations from Manhattan. We'll probably have a multi-station system on the 1710 channel later this year.
Outstanding. Well, we got to take a break here real quick. This is Mike Williams, Ted Adams, Richard Dugan on the board. Visiting today with Bill Baker, Information Station Specialist. Website of the day again, www.theradiosource.com. This is KZSB AM 1290, Santa Barbara News Press Radio and newspress.com. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Welcome back to Community Alert, folks. Taking a closer look at our personal and neighborhood preparations for disaster. I'm Ted Adams. Mike Williams is my co-host, and today we're with Bill Baker, Information Station Specialist, talking to us from Michigan. And, Bill, just something that you touched on just at the end of the last segment about the diminishing amount of AM radios, does that mean that there's going to be more room and larger venue for these stations, or is that going to affect that at all?
Well, it seems like that's the trend. It may be a very long and slow trend, but the FM band is only getting more crowded. And the AM band seems to have a little bit more breathing room than it used to, especially the top end from 1610 up to 1700.
And that's quite a bit of space, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of possibility within that. They just expanded that not too long ago from 16, or maybe it's been 25 or 30 years now. But
it seems like just yesterday.
Yeah, you're still thinking about those 8 tracks, aren't you?
Most of the stations, though, are up in that area.
Anyway, Bill, how do emergency managers across the country use these stations now? Because this is kind of a new tool for them, isn't it?
It is, and you know, emergency managers don't think about this as the end-all of emergency management communication. They think of low-power AM as one of many tools that you have that they have to talk to residents, okay, because not everybody has the particular receiver or PDA in front of them at any one time. So obviously the idea is to put the word out in many different avenues as possible. But this one is kind of unique in that it's about the only way, if you think about it, that the emergency manager has of speaking directly to the public, almost like a big bullhorn. You know, when something happens, an emergency manager or public safety official, he wants to get up on top of the tallest building with some mega bullhorn and speak directly to everybody. But obviously that's not possible. The siren system of old was kind of that way. It kind of meat-axed the process and just told everybody that something was wrong, but not what it was. And so, you know, modern ways of communication try to inform as well as to just notify. But the beauty of emergency advisory radio, sometimes it's thought of as if there's not a lot of third parties involved. A lot of the methods that are higher tech involve going through third parties, such as the phone company, email or text companies, going through cell phone, even going through commercial radio. There's a third party involved, and the emergency manager doesn't really have control of the product quite the way he does if he can kind of get his hands on the content. And so that's what we see as being the big selling point for emergency management of this type of system.
What I like about it is you can just call the station on the telephone and talk right into it like you do an answering machine, and it's going right out on the air. We can also do it live. We did do it live during the Gap fire. We were not live on the T fire. However, through Sempers and some of the equipment we have, we were able to bring KZSB live from the fire. So we were, you know, indirectly, we did the same thing. Again, that's working with a commercial broadcasting station. We've been able to supplement our service quite a bit.
What are the keys to this, Mike? I'm sorry to interrupt. But one of the keys, that, and obviously this is so obvious that people forget to say it, is that virtually everybody has access to an AM radio receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the higher tech and more modern methods of communication in an emergency depend upon a special device of some sort. Now, email is pretty ubiquitous, but it's not very portable. And a lot of other things are there, text messages and such. If you aren't carrying the, you know, if you don't have that method, it's not universal. And so the thought is, all right, you know, most people have an AM radio somehow or can get one. Most of them have a battery up underneath it so that if the power's down, it will operate.
Well, just having it in your vehicle, most cars have got that capability.
Well, you brought up a good point because we've gone into a collaborative effort with the Santa Barbara chapter American Red Cross for AM radios, and they have four different varieties of radios that have hand cranks, batteries, and what have you, the different methods of power for them. And you can listen to 1040, and they work really well. They work better than the car radios do, for sure. And I actually use them for our field testing. And we've encouraged people to go to the Red Cross and or wherever they want to go, but the Red Cross has them in stock, and buy one of these emergency radios. They've got a flashlight built into a couple of the models, and they work out really well. And for these low-power emergency stations, it's just the perfect complement.
Well, on the transmit side, too, most of the stations have batteries up underneath them to operate them when the power goes out.
And ours does.
Right. What good would that be if the station went off just when you needed it most?
Well, you know, we were tested with 1040 three times with the Zacka fire, the Gap fire, and as well as the T fire. And we were having significant power problems during the Gap fire. Although our stations and everything remained on the air, the power was a big problem because the fire was in the primary transmission lines. And again, that happened down in Montecito during the T fire for their distribution system. And yet the AM station stayed on the air. So the emergency power system is critical in making these things work. Workforce, and they've stood up in some pretty dynamic testing.
And from the listener's point of view, it's a continuous source, unlike a lot of the methods which give you a burst of information and then it goes back to maybe what it was doing before, or it's silent. People know that they can tune to 1040, and it's always going to be giving them the current update.
And that's a big point with people, because what happens is they end up spinning the dial, and they get frustrated, and they miss a great deal of the information that's coming out on the commercial stations because they're only getting 5 minutes out of the half hour or something like that, whereas they can know that they can tune to our station, and it's up all the time,
now,
as you said.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. One of the features that these stations have that I think is great is the NOAA alert, EDS systems, and that also ties into the Red Cross portable radios. Can you explain a little bit how that works?
Most of your listeners are probably familiar with the National Weather Radio stations and such, and, you know, NOAA and the National Weather Service, and what they call now the All Hazards Warning Service, is probably the most universal and targeted means of getting emergency information, not just of weather, but of all kinds of hazards in front of the public. The downside being it takes a special receiver to receive it.
Mm-hmm.
And so over the years, emergency managers have wanted to integrate the audio from these weather all hazard stations into their AM emergency advisory broadcast. And that's what the products now do. As soon as the National Weather Service or the federal government identifies your county as being a county that has a hazard exposure, all of a sudden it interrupts your messages, or you can certainly set it to do that, to broadcast it to broadcast that emergency information immediately. Tornado bulletin, which is, of course, big here in the Midwest, but let's say you have Santa Ana wind situation. Let's say you've got a mudslide or fire situation, which, you know, happens out in your area, of course, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to be broadcast automatically. But emergency managers also want to be able to trump that, because sometimes you know a lot more than NOAA does about a particular situation. And so modern emergency systems allow that automatic preemption by NOAA, but also for you to have complete control over that, too.
Excellent. Well, let me give the information out about how to get these portable radios. This is part of the Red Cross Be Red Cross Ready program. They're available at the Santa Barbara office, chapter headquarters at 2707 State Street in Santa Barbara. They're also available at their Santa Maria office, 3030 Skyway Drive in Santa Maria. You can also get information about the radios at www.sbredcross.org. That's sbredcross.org. We're coming up to our next break here. This is Community Alert with Ted Adams, Mike Williams, Richard Dugan on the board. Visiting today with Bill Baker, Information Station Specialist. The website of the day, www.theradiosource.com. That's theradiosource.com. If you have any interest in exploring further about these stations, you can give them a call directly at 616-772-2300. That's 616-772-2300. This is Community Alert, KZSB AM 1290, Santa Barbara News Press Radio and newspress.com. We'll be with you in just a moment.
The views expressed on Community Alert are not necessarily those of the staff, management, ownership, or advertisers of this station.
Welcome back, folks, to Community Alert, KZSB Radio, taking a closer look at our personal and neighborhood preparations for disaster. Myself, Ted Adams, Mike Williams, and today we're with Bill Baker from Information Station Specialist, talking to us from Michigan. And, Mike, you want to go with a question for...
Well, Bill, we're in our last segment here, and I want to make sure we cover everything. I guess one of the big questions left on our list here is, how has this evolved? How has low-powered radio evolved, and where is it going?
Well, you know, we've talked a little bit about the evolution in terms of who's using it, but technically, everybody's always interested in the technical stuff. When I first looked at this industry as it stood in the late 1980s, there were actually 8-track tapes that were running continuously, running the audio. And you think, okay, well, somehow there's got to be a way of repeating the audio round and round. And gosh, you know, loop tapes like that from 8 tracks or continuous cassettes, that's kind of an oxymoron, actually, the concept of continuous cassettes, right? They eventually break. And so I don't think this industry would be here that we're in were it not for digital audio recording. And even though digital sounds pretty new, it really began back in the late 70s and the early 1980s. And it allowed, for example, Caltrans to run a complete state full of these radio stations by telephone.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to record audio by phone, you know, manage it and loop it at different locations along Interstate 5 and the other freeways, kind of happened in the 1980s and such. So that whole digital thing happened, and that allowed really the industry to take off. But today what we're seeing is audio managed not in a telephone means so much as by the computer. Many of the operators of these radio systems have telephone operation like your system does, as well as a PC that allows somebody to kind of drop and drag the audio files, working with MP3s, network-based operation where you might be able to control the radio station from anywhere on a city or county network. That's, you know, become huge. Out in Arizona, they have systems that are, you know, being uplinked with audio from satellite, where, you know, the state capitol is controlling the operation of multiple stations with satellite uplinks through an Ethernet network.
So they're basically doing the same thing that the commercial broadcasters are doing.
In ways. Yeah. And text-to-speech, too, which is big because... for example, one of your area communities, it's a little bit to the south of you, Santa Monica, and I think Montecito, too.
Montecito's got it also.
The ability to drop and drag text into a screen and have it broadcast. Why does that, you know, that sounds like, gosh, that would sound like it's a computer talking to you, but and it doesn't anymore, but it gets the exact text that somebody who's issuing a warning wants broadcast.
Well, and that's very important because the language is critical, and a lot of time is spent making sure the language is a certain way, and then if I take a copy and I read it and I don't read it the same way, that causes problems.
A lot of these stations, Mike, are used for Amber Alerts. and you want to very quickly get
right.
the detail of the Amber Alert exactly the way it's been issued.
The thing that'd be interesting to me, Bill, is how do they get the inflection? I mean, you can say the same thing many, many different ways, and sometimes it sounds comical, sometimes it sounds too serious, sometimes it sounds stilted. How do those programs, how do they do that? How do they do that?
Well, they only have a certain ability to be able to swing that kind of nuance back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty straight. And also, I think the context of the message itself sort of dictates how it's interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you listen to NOAA, you know you're talking about the weather. You know you're
right.
talking about the wave height out of the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really, you're not going to get a lot of belly laughs out of
right.
that.
Right, it's not too riveting. Right.
No, not from Lars.
Right.
Our automated voice is rather automated.
Yeah.
Oh, you have that out there too?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, we call him Lars out here. But anyway, well, we're coming up to the close of the show. Is there any last thoughts that you have before we go?
Everyone I meet is from California.
That means they are from California?
It means there's about 5 feet of snow here, and I wish I was where you are.
Yeah,
well, it's been a pleasure to be on with you, though, guys. Thank
you
so much.
Thank you very, very much, and I know you've taken some special time out for us, and I appreciate it, and I know there's people out there listening today that do have an interest in low-power AM radio. It's a hot topic here in Santa Barbara. It constantly comes up, and I appreciate you taking time out to talk to us.
Thanks. My pleasure.
You're very welcome. The website again today is www.theradiosource.com. That's theradiosource.com. We've been speaking today with Bill Baker, President, Information Station Specialist. Their telephone number again, 616-772-2300. That's 616-772-2300. This is Community Alert, not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster. Ted Adams, Mike Williams, Richard Dugan on the board. KZSB AM 1290, Santa Barbara News Press Radio and newspress.com. We'll talk to you next week.
This has been Community Alert. Community Alert is produced by the Santa Barbara County Fire Safe Council in association with the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department. Production assistance provided by Richard Dugan and Jim Williams. This is KZSB AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.